Okay, thank you for coming to this session. My name's Helen Ward. I'm a Professor of Infectious Disease Epidemiology at Imperial College London. It's my pleasure to be moderating this session, this plenary session, this afternoon. This session is about social and behavioural issues in relation to sexually transmitted infections. And as you're all aware, and we've heard plenty of already in this conference, many, many STIs are challenging us. They remain either endemic or epidemic in certain parts of the world, despite the fact that we have very effective treatments, we have some effective interventions, we have lots of diagnostic tools. And underlying our inability to control these in some areas is the rather more difficult to control sexual behaviour. And so we're going to have two plenary speakers on these issues. So it's my pleasure first to introduce our first speaker, who is Professor Dayman Johnson. She is the Professor of Infectious Diseases at University College London. She's also chair of the UCL Grand Challenge for Global Health. And she has worked for slightly longer than me in this area. We've known each other for many years, so we've worked for 2 to 3 decades on sexual behaviour and transmission of STI and HIV. Anne is the principal investigator for, well, I will say, probably the most famous national sexual health and behaviour survey in the world, which is the British National Study of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyle. And there's just been the third round of that, spanning 20 years, and the third one has been published relatively recently, and that is what part of what Anne's going to talk about today. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Anne Johnson.
Thank you, Helen, and good afternoon, everyone, and thank you also for the invitation to Atlanta. It's lovely to be here and to meet so many people again and hear so much great science. I'm going to talk about sexual behaviour in general population studies by and large, but I do want to really emphasise a point that has repeatedly come up in this conference, that when we think about sexual health, we shouldn't limit ourselves to just sexually transmitted infection, but to the broader conceptualisation of sexual health as laid out by the WHO in relation to safe and planned pregnancies, the avoidance of sexual violence and the importance of consent and pleasure in sexual relationships, the importance of sexual function and sexual satisfaction throughout the life course context of relationships and in the context of broader general health. What I want to talk about is how is sexual behaviour in general populations and its social drivers changing over time, looking back over the last 60 years. Think about how those impact on STI transmission. Have a little segue into the question of methodology, and then finally think a little bit about prevention and policy implications. This is not a systematic review. This is some of the material I've drawn on for this talk. But just to remind you of the national probability, population probability sample surveys that have been carried out throughout the world. What I want to emphasize in this slide is that these surveys vary greatly in their methodology, in their sample size, in the size of the population they surveyed, and I'm limiting myself to broad population surveys, not surveys of particular risk groups or sectors of the age group at risk, for example. And the surveys highlighted in red there are those that have been specifically focused on sexual behaviour in Britain, USA, France, Australia, and a recent publication, which is really very impressive, in South Africa. Those in the darker colour are those that are really sexual behaviour questionnaires embedded within general social surveys. The point here being that methods matter when it comes to thinking about how we measure these things. You can see from that slide that sample sizes vary from a few thousand to nearly 40,000. Age groups' ranges are different, and that people have used very different methods for collecting data in their questionnaires, from phone methods to face-to-face methods to the use of computer-assisted interviews, and there is varied collection of biological specimens. However, I am going to abuse the position of being allowed to give this plenary to talk about my own study, the National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles, and many of the team involved in that are here, and I'll tell you more about that. But first, to say something about methods. Methods matter for comparisons between and within surveys. Some of the surveys that are general health surveys, for example, have very many fewer questions than detailed sexual behaviour surveys such as the British NatSal or the NSF, the detailed surveys here in the United States or the Australian survey. The sampling frame matters, whether you're going for households or individuals, whether you're going by the internet using a quota sample, and so on. The question wording is critical, and I think we could probably spend most of this time in this session discussing what is a partner, so we don't all use the same definitions. And we know that the questionnaire format is very important, and we get greater disclosure of sensitive behaviours where there are self-completion methods compared with face-to-face. That's been well shown in many studies, and computer-assisted interviews compared with pen and paper interviews. And finally, perhaps we know least of all about the veracity of telephone interviews. There are some methodological experiments, if you're interested, presented from NatSal here. Phil Prahr will be speaking tomorrow morning on a comparison between the General Health Survey for England, which used NatSal detailed the NatSal questions in a pen and paper interview, and then we compared them with the results from NatSal and found lower rates of reporting sexual behaviour. Phil will be talking about why that might be the case. Based on methodology. We've done quota samples from four internet panels using the same questions, fewer questions, but nevertheless the same questions, and there's a poster by Sarah Burkill looking at those results, the main conclusion being we get very variable results in terms of risk behaviours. And Kath Mercer has a poster today looking at questions and the formatting of questions and the differences one gets between measuring concurrency by direct question and using overlap in the timing of partnerships. This is a topic which is much discussed, and there are some interesting results, I think, which mirror some other work that I understand has been done in Seattle. So just to tell you a bit more about NatSal, since I will be focusing somewhat on that, the National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles in Britain has involved surveys in 1990, 2000 and 2010, in other words, 10 years apart. We got very brave this time and asked people all the way up to the age of 74 about their sexual activities. Our sample sizes ranged from 12,000 to 19,000. Our questionnaire started as a pen and paper interview, self-completion interview, and is now a computer-assisted self-interview for the sensitive questions. And for the last two surveys, we've collected urine for sexually transmitted infections. Here's the team. If you're interested in knowing more about NatSal, all the material presented here is uploaded on the NatSal website as shown there. And I'd like to acknowledge the team, the many institutions and funders involved. I want to draw now on changes in behaviour over time. I will draw on that cell, but I want to show this compared with data from other surveys. This is Kath Mercer's paper in The Lancet, published in November last year. I think this is familiar territory from some of the stuff that was covered by King yesterday, but to remind you of the extraordinary changes, demographic changes and changes in sexual behaviour which have occurred over the last 60 years, which is a very important determinant transmission dynamics for some STIs. First of all, the declining age at first sexual intercourse, which has declined from a median of 19 for men to 16 and a median of 20 to 16 between people born in 1935 and people born 60 years later in 1990. This is an extraordinary decline in the age at first intercourse. What we also find is that the age at first cohabitation has risen, and this is common to many other countries, and the age of having a first child has risen, such that the gap between first sex and first child is now around 12 years for women. And during that period, not only will people be likely to change partners more often, but in addition, they need protection from unwanted pregnancy, and they need a whole range of sexual health services, which is what many of us in this room spend our lives doing. This is exactly mirrored by data from the French survey. You can see here the decline in median age at first sexual intercourse by age and birth cohort in France. And this also demonstrates some of the social changes in society. Perhaps the best way to summarise those are really the changes which have altered women's lives specifically, their greater economic freedom, their involvement in the workplace, their ability to control their fertility through contraception and abortion, and also huge change in attitudes to sex, which we've observed in a number of countries. The first HIV prevention campaign occurred across the world in 1987. People often say to me that you can't change sexual behaviour by behavioural interventions, and I kind of beg to differ. Wait a minute. Something's missing there. Had that slide been there, which it doesn't appear to be, so I will describe it to you in graphic detail, it would show you that in France, Britain and Australia, there are exactly mirrored graphs which show a rapid increase in the rate of condom use at first intercourse, which starts, it's not that one, which starts in, it's got it in for me anyway, never mind, which starts in 1987, and the rate of condom use in Britain rose from 30% to over 90% and has remained stable since that time. It's mirrored in almost every other data set in the world. So while we've been very good at changing behaviour very rapidly in the face of a major threat, it's been much more difficult to sustain it. These are data from the South African survey showing condom use at last sex. And I think given what we all know about the size of the South African epidemic, I have a problem. I think I have an IT problem. Am I getting extra minutes, Chair? Okay, stay. It's been much more difficult to sustain the increase in condom use. So you can see in South Africa how much condom use rose between 2000 and 2008, but it has since fallen quite dramatically at a time when also there has been a diminution in the number of in the intensity of public education campaigns. In Britain, there's been a small decrease in condom use in young people, although this is not statistically significant. So sustaining behavioural change is very difficult when threats may seem less intense. The other thing is that's happened is that over the last 60 years, and these are data are plotted not by age at birth, by age at first intercourse, the number of sexual partners that people have has increased quite markedly. This is the proportion of people reporting 10 or more partners in the NatCell data, and the two things to notice. First of all, those, as you can see, in 1950 who had sex in 1955 have accrued fewer partners than those who first had sex in the 1990s. And the gap between the women and the men has markedly diminished, and really over the last 10 years, the upward trajectory has not continued. Indeed, if we look overall at changes in sexual behaviour in Britain, and I think there are perhaps fewer data, the longitudinal data for me to share from other countries, but we've seen in Britain that between 1990 and 2000, we saw quite substantial increases in risk behaviours, an increase in the number of people having 10 or more lifetime partners and 2 or more partners in the last year, more men paying for sex, an increase in same-sex sexual experience in both men and women. And we were really quite surprised 10 years ago at the extent of these. But when we reflected, we realised, of course, this was a kind of reversion after the decline in risk behaviours at the end of the 1980s following the concerns about the HIV epidemic. And we saw increasing risk behaviour in that 10 years. We were very uncertain what we'd see between 2000 and 2010, given the increased intensity of discussion about sexual matters in the media and really sort of changing society, people, social media and different ways people were meeting partners and different social networks. So in a way, I suppose we were quite surprised to find that rather little had changed in that cell between 1990 and 2000, with if anything a small decline in amongst men in reporting two or more partners in the last year, and absolutely no change at all in the proportion of men saying they'd had same-sex experiences. Not so for the women. The women were reporting more lifetime partners in the top there, and the most remarkable thing, and this has been recorded in other societies, an increased reporting of same-sex experience and same-sex partners amongst women, although most of these women are not by no means exclusively homosexual, they are women who have heterosexual partners as well. So far more change amongst the women than amongst the men. The issue of increasing numbers of sexual partners is also seen in the South African data. And again, I think there could be cause for concern in these data, given the magnitude of the HIV epidemic in South Africa. And you can see the increasing proportion of men reporting two or more partners in the last year, although that and an increase amongst the women which is not so marked. And I think we could talk here perhaps in some of these measures of the closing of the gap between men and women of the extent to which social desirability bias plays into these data. Turning then to heterosexual practices. This is the sort of repertoire of sexual practices in the British National Survey shown by age. If you look at the top left-hand corner, vaginal sex being the most common activity, but declining in frequency rapidly with age, particularly for women who are far more likely to be without partners later in life. However, the practice of oral sex and anal sex has become more common. We have very good data looking at cohort effects to show rapid increases in oral sex, in the prevalence of oral sex over the last 60 years, and also more recently as well in the frequency of anal sex. This is mirrored in a number of other surveys, which I can show you here, and this clearly has implications both for protection in terms of the practice of oral sex from STIs and from an unplanned pregnancy, but also the risk of other STIs in relation to anal sex. In the United States, data from the NSFG show remarkably similar patterns of sexual practice. This is lifetime sexual practices in the United States are very similar to those in the British survey, with anal sex being the least frequent activity. And I think, interestingly, from the Australian data, and again mirrored in the British data, is that the practice of oral sex used to be something, if you look at the top red line, which started, which people had their first experience of oral sex after their first vaginal intercourse, and that's been reversed in that now the ages are now similar, if not less, for first oral sex experience. And we can also see that in the United States data, and this is again NSFG data, there's a significant proportion of young people, 15 to 17 years, 10%, who've only had oral sex prior to the experience of vaginal intercourse. So clearly evidence of a practice which we could see as in, at least in part, having a being protective. Now, here's one that I am unable to understand. And this is one that I ask the statisticians to correct the data every which way, that apparently in the population, the frequency with which people have sex in the last 4 weeks has declined over the last 20 years, quite substantially, from a median of 5 to a median of 3. The explanation for this is in partly demographic, because people are less likely to be living with a partner, and partner availability is a major factor in the frequency with which people have sex. But that doesn't explain it all, because the frequency has also declined amongst married couples. However, the press did have an idea about what this was about, and they thought this was all just sitting embedded with our laptops. However, there is absolutely, for the avoidance of doubt, no scientific evidence for this. This comment, this resulted from a comment made at a press conference by a nameless member of the team. It was a sort of, why? Oh, I was thinking they're all too busy on the internet. But maybe we are all just getting too busy. Anyway, one way or other, there seems to be a decline in frequency. But as you can see, women are romping for 60 years of their life, so it's not all bad. Now, when we turn to the matter of partners, the number of partners that we have is very important in at a population level in driving the transmission dynamics of HIV. And this graph of the distribution of number of partners in the last 5 years must be one that you could sort of reproduce, not in exactly in quantitatively, but in its shape for almost any society, in that the majority of people have zero or one partner in the last 5 years, but a small proportion have 10 or more partners. And it is, of course, the groups with large numbers of partners that are very important in driving transmission dynamics, and I want to say a little bit more about those. In relation to the transmission of sexually transmitted infections, and these are, again, data from NATSAL published in The Lancet. These are our data for the prevalence in people aged 16 to 44 of four STIs, with the most common one, unsurprisingly, being HPV, and chlamydia being found at a prevalence of 1.5% and 1.1% in men, but highest in those aged 16 to 24 years old. And if you want to know the other, the fifth STI we tested for, which is then genitalium, then please go to Nigel Field's Late Breaker on Thursday. You notice there is a bit of advertising in this talk. But just to say something about who is acquiring chlamydia in these surveys. Now, I think in almost every country in Europe and North America, we've seen increased screening for chlamydia, and thus we have more people reporting chlamydia diagnosis in the past 5 years. So in the last, between NATSAL 1 and NATSAL 2, we've seen a really remarkable increase in the number of people reporting they've had a chlamydia diagnosis, not because of transmission, but because of opportunistic testing. But unlike, for example, in the United States, where there's some evidence from the NSFG that chlamydia prevalence has been declining in 14 to 19-year-olds, we have not really been able to demonstrate a decline in Britain. Whether this is just due to the fact we haven't got the power from our studies to do so, or whether it's to do with methodologies, we're not sure, but we cannot confidently say, or we have no evidence to suggest there has been any decline because of the amount of screening. And I think it's very interesting then to think about the patterns of screening in relation to sexual behaviour. This is a bit of a difficult slide, but just let me take you through it. The solid lines in blue and green reflect the measured prevalence by age in the NATSAL data from a testing of samples of participants. And what you note is that the highest prevalence for men is in those aged 20 to 24, and the highest prevalence for women in the solid line green is in those aged 16 to 20. The blue dotted line and the large dashed line reflects the reporting of having been diagnosed with chlamydia, again with a peak in the 20 to 25-year-old men and the younger women. The red dotted line, however, reflects who we're screening. And the people who are getting tested for chlamydia are actually the young men aged 16 to 18, where there's very little infection, and not the older men aged 20 to 24. So at age 24, we're managing to screen 45% of women, but only 25% of men. Why is that important? It's important that something that we have, that really I think we should pay more attention to in STI epidemiology, which is the difference in age between participants and most recent partners. We have, for example, 16 to 19-year-old men tend to have partners the same age as themselves. That's the top right-hand quadrant. Women aged 16 to 19 tend to have older partners. Women aged 20 to 24, on the other hand, have older partners still, and men aged 20 to 24 have partners younger than themselves. So the older men, where the infection resides, are not well screened, and they're having sex with the younger women. And it may be, in part, this mismatch between where the infection is and the screening patterns that is hampering our efforts. Age mixing very important in the HIV epidemic in South Africa, with a rising rate of young people reporting that they have age disparate relationships, and women having partners who are male partners much older than them, and this is probably important in maintaining the epidemic. Chlamydia is more common in those with multiple partners. And indeed, we found that in men in particular, there is a sense of a core group of men, where 75% of men diagnosed in the last 5 years, diagnosed and detected, were amongst the 25% with 10 or more lifetime partners, while in women, only around 40% of the diagnosed and detected chlamydia was in the 21% with 10 lifetime partners. So a sense possibly that you've got a relatively small group of highly active men who are likely to be infected and who have many partners, but maybe the numbers of partners amongst women who become infected is rather fewer. Similarly, as another core group of interest, I think, are men who pay for sex. And here you can see that men who paid for sex in Natsal are those who have on average 31 partners in a lifetime, compared with 13 for all men. And I think we usually think maybe all their partners are paid, but in fact the minority of their partners are paid. Only six of their on average partners are paid against their total of 31. So most partners among men who pay for sex are unpaid partners, and this seems to me this is an important group of people, an important marker of risk for STI transmission. And indeed, amongst the 3.6% of men who paid for sex in the last 5 years, accounted for in the data set nearly 15% of all partnerships and nearly 16% of all STIs. So again, an important group. HIV testing is increasing in many countries, including in Britain, but HIV risk perception, if anything, is declining. This is mirrored in the South African data, where I think worryingly, despite the magnitude of the epidemic, in almost all the groups at highest risk, young women and people who are living together and not married at high risk of HIV, risk perception of HIV, if anything, is declining even in the face of a major epidemic. So turning then to sexual behaviour in the context of the South African epidemic, you can see here that the prevalence of HIV, the age distribution in 2012, is now the prevalence is higher because of treatment. The age distribution is moving to the right as people age and they're living longer. So although the prevalence is increasing, nevertheless, although incidence is declining in young women aged 15 to 24, there's no indication that incidence has declined overall in adults aged 15 to 49, and there are still, really, in all the data I've shown, increases in risk behaviour. So this is a comment from the South African report. It's conceivable that the beneficial impact of increased ART coverage has been more than offset by disturbing trends of increased risk behaviour, and social and behavioural interventions have largely fallen by the wayside. And a call for balanced treatment and prevention. And this is, I think, a recurring theme which we could well pay heed to in countries in Europe and the United States. We've heard much of this. In the United Kingdom, in London, the incidence of HIV has not changed despite greatly increased uptake of HIV testing. 80% of people tested, 80% diagnosed, and 80% of those on treatment, but incidence unchanging. So we really do need to go back to this question of behavioural intervention. One other thing, very briefly, I haven't had time to talk about the other quadrants of sexual health, but it does seem to be that non-volitional sex is an area that we should pay more attention to. We asked these questions in NatCell this time: has anyone actually made you have sex with them against your will? And in response to that question, it's the bar on the right, nearly 10% of women and 1.4% of men said they'd experienced completed non-volitional sex. And I think the thing that is of greatest concern of all is that if you look at the experience of non-volitional sex, only a very small proportion of those who have experienced non-volitional sex have told anybody about it. This is a very hot topic currently in Britain, and one which I think we don't really have the right services for, and quite rightly falls within the remit of broader sexual health services. In conclusion, then, Sexual behaviour in general populations has changed greatly. The economic drivers and the position of women are hugely important to determinants. The HIV impacts can be striking, and behavioural interventions can have big and rapid impacts, but there is evidence of risk compensation in many at high risk, and kind of fatigue. I'm not sure if it's fatigue amongst people. I think it's fatigue amongst public health people to go on with behavioural interventions for one generation after another, declining awareness of HIV in some areas. So we need to think about the importance of large-scale population surveys to understand drivers and impacts, looking at survey methodology, the role of high-risk men, age mixing and concurrency, and linked biological data. We do need a better understanding of the relationship of behaviours and STIs for intervention design. And also, I really do believe that sexual health and education programmes have got taken too much of a back seat. They need to be reinvigorated and taken beyond STI transmission to address all the aspects of sexual health, including violence, contraception, sexual function and well-being, in a much more holistic way. I think that's a real challenge for the future. I would love to tell you more, but I know that I can't, and I'm probably over time. Thank you for your attention.